Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. On behalf of the Wyoming Supreme Court's Children's Justice Project, I would like to welcome you to the CJP monthly training series. The training is offered the second Thursday of every month from 12 p.m. to 1 p.m. for key stakeholders involved in the Wyoming juvenile court system. We have a great training lined up for you today. To download the materials for today's training, please visit the CJP website at www.courts.state.wy.us/CJP and click on the training tab. If you have questions, please call in during the last 10 minutes of the training. The phone number is 917-889-8064. Again, that number is 917-889-8064. You may also post questions and comments using the chat session on the Blog Talk Radio website. After today's training, please go to the CJP webpage to complete a survey. We hope you find today's training beneficial.
Welcome, everyone, and thanks for joining us. Today is part two on a two-part series about parent representation. Today we have Lisa Finke with Finke Law in Gillette, Wyoming, and she's going to be focusing on the representation of parents in Wyoming juvenile court proceedings. In 2016, Ms. Finke authored a handbook titled Representing Parents in Abuse and Neglect Proceedings, an Advocacy and Training Guide for Wyoming Practitioners. And this was published by the Children's Justice Project. And again, this two-part series focuses on materials in the handbook. The presentation will provide information to assist attorneys that are practicing child welfare law and highlights information contained within the handbook. Just a reminder that if you would like to reference a handbook during the session, it is on the CJP website to download right now. And feel free to log into the chat. If you have questions, you can ask them at any time, and I'll hold them for the last 10 minutes during the question time. All right, Lisa, I'll hand it over to you.
Thank you. I'm glad to be back again today to continue talking about representing parents in abuse and neglect proceedings. As was stated, this is part two of a two-part series on representing parents in abuse and neglect proceedings. The first part aired on February 8th of this year and is archived on the Wyoming Children's Justice Project website. For anyone who missed that first part and would like to go back and listen to that at a later time, because this is a two-part series, we are somewhat jumping into the middle of a presentation. So for those of you that were not able to attend on February 8th, if it seems like we're jumping into the middle of things, that's because we are. We're about halfway through this presentation. Last time, we talked about representing parents in abuse and neglect proceedings in the context of the ABCs of representing parents. What we're doing with these two series are we're talking very broadly about basic general concepts of representing parents in abuse and neglect proceedings, giving a broad overview of what's going on there, and talking about the high points of the Parents Attorney Manual that was published by the Children's Justice Project. Again, my name is Lisa Finke. I'm an attorney in Gillette, Wyoming. I have been working with the Children's Justice Project to travel around the state and train parents' attorneys in hopes to encourage attorneys to participate in this particular area of law and to think about improving the quality of their representation for parents. I do try to consult with other attorneys when I'm available to answer any questions that they would have. So if anyone has any particular questions or issues that they feel like they would like to speak about more in depth with me, I can always be reached at my office. My office number is 307-686-4122. If anyone has anything further they'd like to discuss with me, or if these trainings kind of trigger anything for anybody that they'd like to discuss further. So as I said, we're talking about the ABCs of representing parents in abuse and neglect proceedings. And last time we made it all the way through the letter M, which leads us to, in the alphabet, the letter N. And N stands for negotiate. And I want to spend a little bit of time talking about negotiation in the context of representing parents in abuse and neglect proceedings. Some attorneys, especially newer attorneys, when they take these cases, when they come in to start practicing in this area, are kind of hesitant to think that there's an opportunity to negotiate for parents in these cases. To many people, it seems like a black and white issue. The parent can either admit that they abused and neglected the child, or they can go to trial. The reality is there is some opportunity to use your negotiation skills for the benefit of your client in these cases. With a abuse and neglect petition, once a petition is filed, there are several options that your client could choose to pursue. Yes, of course, they could always admit the allegations of the petition. They could always go in and say, what the state has alleged is true, I admit. Or, of course, they could request a trial. In abuse and neglect proceedings, parents do have the right to a jury trial. And so a parent could request either a jury trial or a bench trial. Now, it's important to know about jury trials in abuse and neglect proceedings that if your client wants to have a jury trial, they have to file a demand for jury trial within 10 days of their first appearance. The law says within 10 days of being advised of the right to a jury trial, the parent has to make that request. So it's very important when you've been appointed to represent a parent that that's one of the first things you discuss with your client is whether or not they wish to proceed to jury trial. If your client opts not to have a jury trial, the matter can also be set for a bench trial in front of the judge. Now, those aren't the only two options that are given to parents in these situations. The first alternative is what's known as a consent decree, which I think most people are fairly familiar with at this point. A consent decree, the best way to describe it is it's the equivalent of a deferred sentence in a criminal case. The parent agrees to the court taking jurisdiction, entering orders, placing requirements on the parent and the children, and agreeing to work with DFS for a period of time, but the actual adjudication of neglect is never entered. What a consent decree is it's actually a contract between the parties saying that the parents will work with DFS for a set period of time and achieve certain goals as outlined in that consent decree, and if the parent successfully achieves those goals, then the matter will be dismissed without an adjudication ever being entered. Consent decrees are negotiated by the parties. There are no required terms. There are no restrictions on what can be included in the consent decree. It all comes down to negotiations between the attorneys as to what a consent decree will involve. Now, if the child is in the legal and physical custody of the Department of Family Services, a consent decree can only be for 6 months. At the end of that 6 months, if the parties agree, they can extend the consent decree for another 6 months. That's what the statute says. Now, if the children are not in DFS custody, the consent decree can be for whatever time the parties agree on. It could be anywhere from 3 months to a year. The possibilities really are endless, and that's somewhere where your negotiation skills can come in. If you have a case where you've been appointed and it seems like an appropriate case for a consent decree, you can negotiate with the county attorney's office for what particular terms should be included in that consent decree. And it's important if you're doing a consent decree that you participate in that negotiation because your client is going to be bound by the terms of that consent decree and the court is going to honor the consent decree as written. So it's important that you negotiate a good consent decree for your client. Now, consent decrees can only be offered at the discretion of the prosecuting attorney. So there will be cases when the prosecuting attorney says, no, I'm not going to do a consent decree. At that point, there are some other considerations that come into place. In some cases, there are going to be situations where it would be detrimental to your client for them to enter an admission in the juvenile case. Not necessarily because the issue is working within the juvenile court, but because there's issues in other settings that will affect your client. For example, a client that has been charged with abuse and neglect for physically abusing a child may also be charged in criminal court with child abuse. If your client goes into juvenile court and makes an admission, and then works with DFS and makes statements in the course of casework or counseling or parenting classes, whatnot, about what happened between them and the child, there's potential for those statements to be used against them in their criminal case. Also, oftentimes, a lot of what happens within juvenile court can be used against your client in civil custody cases, divorces, child custodies, guardianships. And so one important consideration is, will an admission harm my client in some other proceeding? And if you have one of those cases where an admission could be harmful to your client, what you could do, depending upon the judge that you practice in front of, would be either a no contest plea or a Rule 7 stipulation. This is going to be dependent upon the judge that you're appearing in front of. The judges throughout the state do this a bit differently. Some judges are willing to accept no contest pleas. Other judges will require that you do a Rule 7 plea. Now, we're referring to Rule 7 of the Rules of Procedure for Juvenile Courts. Rule 7 of the Rules of Procedure for Juvenile Courts states that the parties can stipulate to any matter, including adjudication. So a Rule 7 stipulation allows your client to go in and say, I agree that the court should enter the adjudication, but I'm not going to make any statement regarding the facts of this case. And so through that Rule 7 stipulation, you can protect your client's right to remain silent and protect them from any statements that could be used against them in another proceeding. Now, what Rule 7 also allows you to do is to have some negotiations with the prosecuting attorney and even the guardian ad litem about what it is that your client is going to stipulate to and what the initial order is going to look like and the initial requirements for your client. Sometimes attorneys just go in and have their clients admit and then wait to see what the state's going to recommend and argue about the terms and conditions in front of the judge. It is possible to negotiate with the prosecutor prior to that about what their recommendations for your client are going to be. And I would encourage attorneys to communicate with their prosecuting attorney in their cases to talk about what those terms and conditions for your client are going to look like and what you can negotiate for the betterment of your client. I also just want to take a moment and talk about Rule 9 of the Rules of Procedure for Juvenile Court. Rule 9 does allow the parties to enter into a stipulation that anything that's said in the process of MDT meetings or case plannings within the juvenile court cannot be used against the parents in further criminal proceedings. I would encourage everyone to spend some time reading Rule 9 and thinking about how they can apply that to their practice and their negotiations. So in the process of negotiation, you should think about whether or not your client is going to admit, plea no contest, do a Rule 7 stipulation, go to trial. But you should also think about whether or not your client should admit to everything in the petition or only portions of the petition if your client's going to admit. You need to be able to explain to your client all the possible consequences of either admitting to or stipulating to any of the facts. And regardless of whether or not there's any ongoing negotiations, you need to continue to prepare and investigate your case to the extent that's necessary to protect your client's rights. So that if negotiations fail, you haven't set your client up to fail at trial. And as always, as an attorney for a parent, you should be discussing the goals of the representation with your client and what your client wants to achieve through the case processes and explaining to them the options and the possible consequences of what's going to happen. Now, negotiation can extend beyond that initial adjudication. Throughout the case, you'll have many opportunities to negotiate with the parties, the requirements for your clients, the options that they could pursue, whether or not certain things should be part of the case plan, whether or not the case should continue to stay open or it should close. You have all sorts of opportunities throughout the case to negotiate with the legal aspect of things, but you also have the opportunity to negotiate with the non-legal parties, such as the Department of Family Services. Some parents' attorneys take the perspective that DFS is the enemy and that they should go in and they should fight everything that DFS wants to do. I personally have taken the perspective that you catch more flies with honey than vinegar. I think that if you build cooperative relationships with the Department of Family Services, where you can have conversations with the caseworkers, where you can talk about your client's needs and the requirements on your client, and be able to negotiate with DFS as well about what your client should be doing and participating in, it makes the cases go faster. It makes it so that DFS is more willing to contact you in advance when there's issues with your clients, and it really helps your client work towards reunification with their children faster. Now, beyond opposing parties, your negotiation skills are also going to be tested in working with your clients as well. Sometimes your clients are going to test your negotiation skills the most. As I mentioned in the last presentation, many times clients are very mad at the system and they perceive you to be part of the system. They don't understand what's going on, and you're going to have to negotiate with them to gain some trust, to convince them to participate in services that they need to participate in but they don't necessarily want to or understand why they need to participate in. And oftentimes, if you can get your client to just get over that initial fear or hesitation of participating in a service, once you get over that initial road bump, your client does well. So you will have to negotiate with your client as well a little bit to get them to move forward with their case and to develop some trust. So moving on from negotiation, the next letter is O, and O stands for obligations. This is another big topic that we need to spend some time on. When you accept an appointment to represent a parent in an abuse and neglect case, or if you're privately retained when you take the case, you take on the obligations of representing that parent in the case. You have some ethical obligations that you have to fulfill. You have some client obligations that you have to fulfill. And you need to be aware of what those obligations are so that you can meet the necessary requirements of representing your client. The National Association of Counsel for Children has put out some guidelines regarding the obligations that a parent attorney has to their client, and I think we should spend some time going over those. So according to the National Association of Counsel for Children, a parent's attorney should acquire sufficient working knowledge of all relevant federal and state laws, regulations, policies, and rules. A parent attorney should understand and protect the parent's rights to information and decision-making while the child is in foster care. You should actively represent a parent in the pre-adjudication phase of a case. You should avoid continuances and work to reduce delays in court proceedings unless there's a strategic benefit to the client. You should cooperate and communicate regularly with other professionals in the case. You should advocate for the client's goals and empower the client to direct the representation and make informed decisions based on thorough counsel. You should act in accordance with the duty of loyalty owed to the client. You should adhere to all laws and ethical obligations concerning confidentiality. You should provide the client with contact information in writing and establish a message system that allows regular attorney-client contact. You should meet and communicate regularly with the client well before court proceedings. You should counsel the client about all legal matters related to the case, including specific allegations against the client, the case plan, the client's rights in the pending proceeding, any orders entered against the client, and the potential consequence of failing to obey court orders or cooperate with service plans. You should work with the client to develop a case timeline. You should provide the client with copies of all petitions, court orders, service plans, and other relevant case documents, including reports regarding the child, except when expressly prohibited by law. You should be alert to and avoid potential conflicts of interest that would interfere with the competent representation of the client. You should act in a culturally competent manner and with regard to the socioeconomic position of the parent throughout all aspects of representation. You should take diligent steps to locate and communicate with a missing parent and decide representation strategies based on that communication. You should be aware of the unique issues an incarcerated parent faces and provide competent representation to the incarcerated client. You should be aware of the client's mental health status and be prepared to assess whether the parent can assist with the case. You should conduct a thorough and independent investigation at every stage of the proceeding. You should interview the client well before each hearing in time to use client information for the case investigation. You should review the Child Welfare Agency case file. Obtain all necessary documents, including copies of all pleadings and relevant notices filed by other parties and information from the caseworker and providers. When needed, you should use formal discovery methods to obtain information. You should develop a case theory and strategy to follow at hearings and negotiations. You should timely file all pleadings, motions, and briefs. You should research applicable legal issues and advance legal arguments when appropriate. You should engage in case planning and advocate for appropriate social services using a multidisciplinary approach to representation when available. You should aggressively advocate for regular visitation in a family-friendly setting. With the client's permission and when appropriate, you should engage in settlement negotiations. You should thoroughly prepare the client to testify at the hearing. You should identify, locate, and prepare all witnesses. You should identify, secure, prepare, and qualify expert witnesses when needed. You should attend and prepare for all hearings, including pretrial conferences. You should prepare and make all appropriate motions and evidentiary objections. You should present and cross-examine witnesses, prepare and present exhibits when necessary. You should actively participate in jury selection if the matter is set for a jury trial, and you should draft appropriate jury instructions. You should review court orders to ensure accuracy and clarity and review them with the client. You should take reasonable steps to ensure the client complies with court orders and to determine whether the case needs to be brought back to court. You should consider and discuss the possibility of an appeal with the client when necessary. If the client decides to appeal, you should file a timely notice of appeal. And you should communicate the results of any motion, hearing, or appeal with the client and the implications of that order. So those are some of the obligations that you have towards clients when you take on abuse and neglect cases. The next letter is P, and P stands for professionalism. In many of these cases, it's easy to be more laid back, to not be as structured with these cases as you are with other cases, because there's a lot of it's hard to describe, but your communications with your clients are more laid back. Your communications with professionals can be more laid back. And it's easy to forget that these cases are court cases and that they need to be treated as such and that you need to bring your professional skills to these cases. For many attorneys that handle different types of cases, sometimes these cases can get treated as not as important as other cases. As the easiest cases to push off and save for later and not spend your time on. But it's very important that these cases be given the same weight as other cases on your caseloads. The far worst outcome of an abuse and neglect case is that your client loses their parental rights to their children. That's a pretty serious consequence. And so we need to treat these cases seriously and give them the focus that they need and act as a professional within the case, because at any moment, one mistake by your client could completely turn this case around. You also need to be professional with other people. Be professional with the other individuals and other professionals that you're working with. Abuse and neglect cases are incredibly emotionally driven. And when we're talking about kids and harm to kids, it's very easy for people to get very emotional. And sometimes what follows when someone gets very emotional is that the rational decision making can sometimes go out the window. And so you have people that get overly emotional, they get irrational. Sometimes they have blowouts in inappropriate situations and places. And when this is happening around you, you need to remember to be a professional and to not lose that degree of professionalism in handling these incredibly emotionally driven situations, and you need to remember to keep your emotions in check. As a professional, you also need to be providing the best quality representation to your client that you can. You are an attorney, you are their legal representative, you need to bring that professionalism with you to MDT meetings, to case planning meetings, to court. You need to show your client that you have the capability to be that professional attorney so that they can have that trust in you. And I kind of stepped a little bit into our next area, which is Q, which stands for quality representation. Everyone is going to define quality representation a little bit differently than everybody else. We all have our own perspective and framework of what we think quality representation is. And dependent upon the client that you get, they're going to have a totally different definition of quality representation as well. You will have clients that you hear from once every 3 or 4 months with a brief update on what's going on, and they think that you're the most wonderful attorney there is. And then you will have clients that call 5 or 6 times a day, email 5 or 6 times a day, and even if you're replying to every single one of those emails and phone calls, they still don't think that you're working hard enough for them. And so when you're trying to decide what quality representation is, you need to make that definition for yourself of what your standard of quality representation is. How often are you going to contact your clients? How often are you going to communicate with them? What are you going to do to make sure that their case is moving forward? And quality representation also entails, what do you need to learn and what do you need to know so that you can advocate for your client within this case? Is there an area of law that you need to learn more about? Do you need to spend more time becoming familiar with case law? Do you need to work on knowing DFS policy? You need to set those expectations for yourself so that you can provide quality representation. And going back to the worst case scenario of your client having their parental rights terminated, you need to figure out what your quality representation needs to look like so that if it comes to that point where someone is recommending termination of parental rights, you can feel like you've done everything within your power to ensure that that particular outcome was avoided on behalf of your client. And so spend some time figuring out what you think quality representation is. The Children's Justice Project has put out standards of practice for parents' attorneys. Those standards of practice can be found on the CJP website. I would encourage you to download those, spend some time looking through them, seeing which particular standards you need to incorporate into your practice, what you're doing well, and what you can improve upon. The other part of quality representation for certain attorneys that can come into play is you need to make sure that you have a manageable caseload. In certain areas, there's only a few attorneys who are willing to take abuse and neglect cases, and so when there's a large influx of these cases, all of those cases get put upon those attorneys who are willing to take the case, and it's pretty easy for your caseload to overwhelm you pretty quickly. There are standards of practice for guardian ad litems, for example, on the number of cases that they should carry. So it's something that's out there that people know that you need to have a manageable caseload in order to provide quality representation for your clients. The next letter in the alphabet is R. R stands for rights. Your client has rights within an abuse and neglect proceeding. And you need to be aware of what those rights are because, number one, you need to be able to advise your client what their rights are. And number two, ultimately, your job in representing a parent in an abuse and neglect proceeding is to protect their rights. And to protect those rights, you need to know what rights they have. So first and foremost, in an abuse and neglect proceeding, a client does have a right to an attorney. In Wyoming, that's a statutory right, as well as a right through the Wyoming Rules of Procedure for Juvenile Courts. That, of course, is why we as attorneys are involved in these cases, because our clients have a right to an attorney. Your client also has the right to consult with you as the attorney before they make any decisions in their case. They have the right to communicate with you, to have you explain the case, explain what's going on, explain the documents. And for them to do that, you, of course, need to be communicating with your client. The statutory right to an attorney in these cases does include the right to court-appointed counsel if a parent cannot afford an attorney. Parents have the right to know what could happen to them if they admit to the allegations of child abuse or neglect, or if there is an adjudication at trial. That's part of your job, to explain fully to the client the consequences of any decision that they make on how to proceed to within the case. You also have the obligation to explain to them the difference between a jury trial and a bench trial, whether or not you believe they should have a jury trial, their right to a jury trial, those types of things. With a jury trial, ultimately your client gets to make the decision on whether or not they have a jury trial in their matter. That is one of their rights. They do have a right to a jury trial. They do have the right to make that decision in the case. If a parent denies the allegations, they do have that right to a trial. They have the right to deny or admit. That's their decision to make on how to proceed with the hearing or with the particular case. Parents have a right to receive notice of all of the court hearings, MDT meetings, case plan meetings, and they have a right to attend those hearings. They have a right to be in court. They have a right to speak on their own behalf if they choose to do so. They have a right to know what's going on in their case. Parents do have the right within an abuse and neglect proceeding to take the witness stand and testify on their own behalf. They are not required to do so, but they certainly can testify on their own behalf if they want to. Because abuse and neglect cases are civil in nature, they do not have a right to refuse to testify, but they can always exercise their Fifth Amendment right to remain silent. However, because it's a civil case, the finder of fact can use their silence against them in any consideration. Parents have the right to cross-examine witnesses in court. If the matter goes to trial and witnesses are called, parents do have the right to cross-examine witnesses and ask their own questions of the witnesses. Parents have the right to work with the caseworker in developing a case plan, and they have a right to receive a copy of that plan. It's really important that you encourage your clients to participate in the case planning process. Number one, so that they have input on the case plan and they know what's going to be required of them, what they have to achieve, and they have a say in what is going on with that case plan. But it's also important that they participate in that case planning process because the statutes do say that if a parent refuses to participate in a case plan or agrees to terms and conditions of a case plan and then chooses not to fulfill them, they can't complain about the case plan at a later point. And that's a huge consideration down the road if your client ever ends up in a termination of parental rights proceeding. So it's very important that your client understands their right to participate in the case plan and that they exercise that right. If you have a client that does not speak English, they do have a right to an interpreter in court to help them understand what's going on in the proceedings and to ensure that they understand everything that's being said in court. Parents have the right to talk to their caseworker. They have a right to talk to their lawyer. They have a right to talk with the parties involved to know what's going on in the case. Parents have a right to visitation in these matters. They have a right to know where their child is, what's going on with their child, what medical treatment their child is getting. However, this right is on a case-by-case basis. A judge can override this right and say, I'm not allowing visitation. There's only going to be supervised visitation. DFS doesn't have to disclose where the child is at. And DFS can make some own internal decisions about how much information they give a parent about where a child is placed as well. So they do have a right to visitation with the child, but that is a right that can be limited based on the facts and circumstances of the case. Parents have the right to receive services and assistance. That's part of what abuse and neglect cases are about. It's about DFS getting involved with the family and working with the family to provide services that are available and appropriate and accessible to help the parent address whatever the situation was that brought the parent to the court. The law requires that DFS provide reasonable effort to the family to either prevent the removal of the child from the home or to reunify the child with the family. So the parent has the right to receive these services from DFS. If the parent is not receiving appropriate services or being required to participate in appropriate services, the parent has the right to go back to court and talk to the judge about what's going on and request that DFS be ordered to provide appropriate services. And that's part of your role as an attorney. If the case is not moving forward appropriately, if your client is not being provided services, if DFS is not holding up their end of the bargain, then you should get back in front of the judge and talk with the judge about what's going on and get an order to have DFS provide the appropriate services. Parents also have the right to receive the written copies of every decision from the court. So copies of all court orders, copies of notice of settings, copy of the case plan. I have seen cases where attorneys have not provided copies of any of the paperwork to their client. Not a good idea, not appropriate. The clients need to have copies of the paperwork. And beyond having copies of the paperwork, the client should be meeting with you for you to go over the requirements of the paperwork so that they understand what they're being ordered to do and what the court has ordered in the case. And parents do have the right to appeal decisions made within abuse and neglect proceedings if the court's issued an order that affects their substantial right. I think a lot of parents' attorneys forget about the right to appeal. It's very important that you're advising your client that they have the right to appeal within 30 days of a court order. The Supreme Court has said that adjudication orders and permanency orders are appealable. I think there's some arguments to be made about other orders coming out of the juvenile court if they meet that appealable standard of affecting a substantial right. And it's something that as parents' attorneys we should be paying attention to and we should be talking with our clients about and making sure that we're covering our bases of advising the clients that they do have the right to appeal certain decisions of the court. Moving on to our next letter. Our next letter is S, and S stands for support. Beyond the legal advocacy in and out of court, you have an opportunity as a parent's attorney to provide support to an individual that's probably at a point in their life when they need a little bit of guidance and support. You have the opportunity to help someone and make a difference in their life. Working with parents in cases like this, what I've discovered is that 95 to 98% of the time, the parent that I'm representing, the parent that I'm working with, was an abused and neglected child themselves. That something happened to them when they were younger and that they were never given the opportunity to move beyond what happened to them. And so they need someone to be the ear to listen to be the support, to take their side. And many times all these parents need is someone to tell them that they can do it. Someone to advocate for them, someone to believe in them, that they're capable of making the changes that they need to make. I personally believe that the opportunities presented by representing parents in these cases give you just innumerable opportunities to improve your abilities as an attorney. To learn how to empathize with people, to understand more about why people act the way that they do, to develop your skills, learn more about the law, learn more about these other sociological and criminological areas that overlap with the law, and to just give you an opportunity to improve your skills relating with other people. So it's kind of a mutual relationship. It gives you an opportunity to improve your skills as an attorney and to help someone out. And at the same time, you're giving support to a person in need, someone who really just needs some guidance and some direction in their life, and you have the opportunity to be that support to them. The next letter is T, and T stands for teamwork. When I travel and give presentations, I often show a picture of the Survivor reality show logo, which is outwit, outplay, outlast. And I tell people that abuse and neglect proceedings are not like a game of Survivor. We're not there to see who can be the last man standing on the island and who we can vote out. It's not about going in and aggressively representing your client and proving that your client was right and everyone else was wrong. Abuse and neglect proceedings are about teamwork, and that's something of a little bit different perspective for a lot of attorneys to take, this idea that we should be cooperating with the opposing parties and working together to achieve an outcome. But really, once your client has been adjudicated, once that finding has been made that the children are neglected, the focus really switches to helping your client work with a team to get out of the system as fast as possible. So you need to spend some time getting to know your client, getting to know what your client needs, and then working with the other parties to make sure that what we're doing is helping your client meet those needs, and that we're always focused on trying to move your client out of the system as quickly as possible. The next letter we have is U, and U is for understanding. Most parents do not end up within the child welfare system by chance. For many of them, they are dealing with issues that they've been dealing with for a while, and in some cases, perhaps even a lifetime. And these issues have continued to build up to the point where things overflow. It begins to affect the children. The children are harmed in some sort of manner, and the system gets involved. And so to adequately represent your client, you have to have some understanding of how it is that they ended up where they are. There are a variety of different factors that can contribute to neglect. And if you don't understand those underlying factors, you're not going to know what your client needs. You're not going to understand why your client ended up in court. And more importantly, you're not going to understand what needs to happen to get your client out of the system. So just touching briefly on a few issues that I think it's important for parents' attorneys to understand. The first one is domestic violence. If you do this for any considerable amount of time, you will probably have a large amount of cases that involve domestic violence. And you're going to see domestic violence a lot with the next issue, which is addiction. You're going to see both of them together. Domestic violence is something that's really unique and hard to just summarize up in a presentation like this. But domestic violence is something that is going to have a huge impact on your case. The research shows that domestic violence has a huge impact on the kids. And most of us know about battered women syndrome and the cycle of violence and how that affects cases such as this. So it's pretty important that you have an understanding of how domestic violence works. Otherwise, you're going to become pretty frustrated with your client pretty quick if you don't understand what those dynamics are. Addiction is the other area that I think parents' attorneys need to spend some time working on. Again, a large amount of these cases are going to involve some sort of drug or alcohol use. And parents' attorneys need to understand addiction and how it works, and beyond that, more specifically, how addiction is treated, what the expectation for your client is going to be as far as treating that addiction, how they're going to respond to treatment, how hard it can be to get them into treatment, and how the addiction is going to affect the family system. I think it's also important that parents' attorneys take some time to understand mental health diagnoses, the variety of different mental health issues that can be out there, what medications are used to treat those particular mental health issues, how specific mental health issues are going to affect your interactions with your client. In the parent's attorney handbook, there is a chapter talking about some of these other issues. In that chapter, there is a chart talking about a few of the more major mental health issues that are seen on that chart was developed with the help of the Department of Family Services clinical staff. They worked with me to come up with that chart, and I appreciate their assistance on that, with some pointers about how to work with certain clients that have certain mental health disorders, and I think that that is a very useful tool. The other big one that I think that parents' attorneys really need to take some time to understand is poverty. I think that this is one that for parents' attorneys has a huge, huge, huge impact on our cases. People who live in poverty live a very different lifestyle. And just because someone lives a lifestyle related to poverty does not mean that they have abused and neglected their kids. And I think that there is a issue with people saying that children who live in that poverty situation are abused and neglected simply because they live in poverty. I think this is a huge issue within child welfare because if you look at who works in child welfare, it is middle to upper class individuals with extended degrees and significant educational background. And I think that we as professionals bring our own biases to the system. And I think without having an understanding of how poverty affects people, it is very easy to let your own judgment and the judgment of others affect how a parent coming from a poverty situation is treated within the court system. So those are the major four that I talk with people about take some time to learn about these four issues: domestic violence, addiction, mental health, poverty. Understand the dynamics of those and how those are going to affect your cases. The next letter is V, and V stands for vocal. We're attorneys. We like to talk. We like to be heard. That's our job, and that's what we need to do for our clients. We need to be vocal. We need to be advocating for our clients. We need to speak up when things are going wrong. We need to bring up issues to the judge. We need to bring up issues to DFS. We need to continually be focused on making sure that our clients' cases are moving forward. We should be bringing up issues in MDT meetings, discussing our client's position, trying to find a resolution. We should be advising the court of any issues that are going on. We should be keeping documentation of our advocacy for our clients, emails or letters that we've sent to other parties questioning why things are not happening, why things are not moving forward. We just need to speak up on behalf of our clients because many times they can't speak up for themselves or they cannot speak up appropriately for themselves. And so it's very important that we be vocal for our clients. The next letter is W, and W stands for work. I am not going to lie. These cases can be extremely hard. They can require a lot of work. One case could blow up and end up taking the majority of your day to work on it. It happens. These cases can be very emotionally draining. They could be very stressful. You can have some very hard cases. So it's important that you work on these cases, that you put the necessary effort into them, that you stay on top of what's going on so that you can know what's going on and advocate for your client. I think a lot of people view juvenile cases, abuse and neglect, as kind of the lesser cases. This is where the attorneys that don't know how to practice law go to practice. I personally do not believe anything could be further from the truth. I think these cases require you to work just as hard as any other case there is out there. And so work on these cases. Work to improve yourself. Work to help your client. Put the effort in. The next letter is X. X is for expect the best. When we do trainings, and I mentioned this in the first session, we oftentimes talk about the negatives, the bad things that happen, how hard they can be, the worst case scenario. The reality is that the majority of these cases, your client has made a mistake, your client knows they've made a mistake, and your client is going to fix the mistake. And you need to expect the best out of your clients. And you need to believe in your clients and their capabilities. And you need to recognize that things are going to get better. And I think you should expect the best out of yourself as well. I think that we all try our hardest. We go in, we do the best job that we can for our clients. We care about our clients, and we should recognize that we really do put a lot of effort in. We really do a lot to help our clients, and we deserve credit for that. And we also deserve to take care of ourselves and expect the best from ourselves and, you know, give ourselves the benefit of the doubt that we are doing quality work for our clients and that we are doing the best that we can to make families stronger and better. That kind of ties in a little bit with Y, which stands for You Can Do It. I really believe that this is productive work. I really enjoy representing parents in these cases, and I think that every attorney out there is capable of doing this work. And I think that every attorney that handles these types of cases deserves a lot of credit and praise for the work that they put into these cases. I think that you will not find more caring individuals than the ones that handle abuse and neglect cases, representing the parents, helping them through and trying to give them guidance. And to everyone out there that represents parents in these matters, I say, I know that you can do it. Thank you for doing it. I'm proud of you for what you've done. And I recognize that what we are doing is good work, and it's necessary work, and it's needed. And so that leads us to our last letter of the alphabet, which is Z. And it should come as no surprise to anyone who's ever tried to come up with an alphabet list of words regarding attorneys that Z stands for zeal. Our ethical obligation as attorneys is to zealously advocate for our clients. And I think everything that we've talked about over these last two sessions really can be summed up by that term, to zealously advocate for your clients. We have an obligation to do our best for our clients. We have an obligation to believe in our clients. We have an obligation to learn about abuse and neglect law and go out there and do the best job that we can to help people who truly need us to improve their lives, to improve their families, and to move on to a better place in their life. So I'll summarize things up very shortly. I appreciate anybody who managed to suffer through two trainings with me on representing parents in abuse and neglect. I really enjoy this work. I wish that more attorneys were willing to do it and to find the fulfillment in this type of work that I have found. So many cases, I've gone into court, I've argued for a client, we have lost miserably in court, including termination cases where I have gone in and lost miserably, and my client has lost their rights to their children. And at the end, my client is the one consoling me and saying, you know what, it's okay, you did a good job, and I want to thank you, because for the first time in my life, I felt like someone fought for me. And that is probably the most fulfilling thing that I can hear from a client, and it's what carries me forward and keeps me fighting for parents in cases like this. So thank you for your time, and if there's any questions, I will answer them.
Thanks, Lisa. Really appreciate it. We do have a question for you here. You were talking about manageable caseloads. The question is, if your caseload becomes unmanageable and the judges are still assigning you cases, what do you think is the best way to handle that?
My first step, if it was me, was I would go and speak with the judges, say, hey, I'm really getting overwhelmed here. I think that I have too many cases. I'm not able to help my client. Can you perhaps not assign me as many cases? If that doesn't work out, if the judge says, no, I'm going to continue to assign cases to you, I think it's really important to kind of go through your cases, make sure you put priorities on the most important things and try to manage those cases, and then start pounding the pavement and calling other attorneys and saying, hey, I need you to step up and try this. Why don't you try it? I think you might like it. But I do know that in certain areas of the state, there are only a handful of attorneys that handle all of the cases, and it very easily can become overwhelming. But I would start first with approaching the judges and trying to have a talk with the judges. They want us to be successful. They want us to do a good job. And I've rarely found that there's not a judge that won't at least listen to you and help you try and problem solve what can be done.
Great, thanks. Okay, another one here for you. Are there any trainings on domestic violence or any other topics that you highlighted that you think are really important for parents, attorneys to know that you would recommend for attorneys to get more information on DV?
As far as the domestic violence goes, what I would encourage people to do is most communities have some sort of domestic violence agency that they can contact their local domestic violence agency and talk with them about what trainings are available and what they can participate in to learn about domestic violence. I would also encourage everyone to, you can get online and you can look up a gentleman by the name of Bruce Perry. He's a doctor that's done a lot of research on neurodevelopmental work, but he's done some work on how domestic violence impacts kids too. And if you look for that work or that particular body of work, I think that's very helpful. And I do know that in Wyoming, we have the Wyoming Coalition Against Domestic Violence based out of Laramie that works with all of the local communities, and they would be more than willing to provide resources to anyone or work with anyone on receiving training specific to domestic violence.
All right, thanks. And then the last question is, are there any key points that you want to leave with the audience before we're done today?
I think that the key points really are, this is a worthwhile area of law to practice. I would encourage people to do that. Care about your clients, care about what's going on with them, and continue to seek out educational opportunities. This is just a particular area of law where the research is always changing, the strategies are always changing, and there's no such thing as knowing too much. I think you can always be learning. And my last takeaway that I kind of leave as a takeaway for everything that I present is really, really emphasize with the professionals that you work with from other agencies how important reunification is. Learn about the benefits of reunification and really advocate for that in all of your cases because it is very important.
Thanks so much for a great presentation, Lisa. Just for everyone else, just a reminder that our next session will be on April 12th at noon, and we hope that you can join us then. And that's the end. Thanks, everyone.